You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Okay, so as you may know from listening to last week's show, I am out of town, but I have pre-recorded a whole slate of what I hope you agree are awesome shows with awesome people. So today's show is going to feature two different interviews, one with author P.E. Moskowitz. They wrote a book called How to Kill a City. They'll be talking about gentrification. And then in the second part of the show, I'll be talking to city council person Kate Burke, because she is the person who brought P.E. Moskowitz to town to talk about gentrification. So she's going to talk about some of her efforts and the efforts of others at the city level to get this work done around gentrification. So I hope you like the show. And I'll be back with another great pre-recorded show next week.
So I'm P.E. Moskowitz. I'm the author of How to Kill a City, Gentrification, Inequality, and the Fight for the Neighborhood. I'm an author and activist. I live in New Orleans. I'm originally from New York City, though, which is how I got kind of interested in gentrification and cities in general. And wrote this book, and I came to Spokane about a month ago to give a talk on the book and to meet with some people in city government and kind of give a warning to Spokane that even though it's a smaller city than many cities that get mentioned in the gentrification conversation, that it's still happening there and something needs to be done about it.
Mm-hmm. So your book, so How to Kill a City, talks about New York City, New Orleans, San Francisco, and Detroit. Is that right? I haven't got my hands on my copy yet, but can you talk about kind of what the commonalities between those four different places are and how gentrification has played out in kind of this predictable way across all those different places?
Sure. So, you know, every city is different, obviously, but there are similarities between all four, and I chose each of the four that I chose mostly because to me gentrification is this very predictable process, and you can show that no matter how different a city is, that the same thing is still happening there. So back in the 1970s, researchers had determined that there were kind of four stages of gentrification. This goes back to this guy, Philip Clay. And he said that, you know, there was the first stage where it was kind of bottom up, you know, people moving in and fixing up places and kind of, you know, doing it on their own. The second phase, kind of more of that. And then the third and fourth phase being more top down, where corporations are coming in. Real estate companies are coming in and doing all the kind of real estate development and gentrification work themselves without the need of the kind of hippies or yuppies or whatever who are moving into the city to kind of do it for them. So theoretically, I mean, I would say Detroit fits into that like first phase, New Orleans the second phase, and then New York and San Francisco in the like third and fourth phase of a more top-down gentrification. But I think what I found in the book is that every single one of those cities and cities in general now, including in Spokane, are kind of skipping the first two phases, and developers and city governments and state governments are like really working hard to gentrify cities on their own without the need for residents to really do anything. So that's what I found in all of those cities, is the kind of phenomenon of city governments and developers and state governments all working together in order to purposefully change cities and make them essentially more unequal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have written on my notes from your talk, not an accidental or nebulous process, ..
Right.
Cities plus real estate developers, smiley face. So that's a really condensed version of what you just said. But
right.
So I guess I'm wondering, and don't feel any pressure to posit yourself as an expert on Spokane, but what did you notice when you were here compared to these other places. I know you got kind of a tour from Councilperson Burke and all of that.
Yeah, Councilwoman Burke was great and drove me around the city and showed me around. And yeah, I'm definitely not an expert on Spokane. The residents of Spokane obviously are more of an expert on their city than I am. But that being said, I think what I am, not to toot my own horn or whatever, but I think what I am an expert at is seeing the similarities there and in every city. Because just I've been to so many different cities, I've reported on so many different cities, and the same thing is really happening in each. So you see this happening in Spokane now where there's, you know, it's kind of starting to bubble up. It's already bubbled up in activist spaces, but now it's bubbling up into like the mainstream discourse, like people starting to be worried about gentrification, starting to be worried about being priced out, about rising real estate prices, and kind of the influence and coziness between developers and the city government. And you can see this in Spokane pretty blatantly. I mean, I think a couple of the council people, or at least one council person, is somehow involved in the real estate industry, if I'm not mistaken. Councilwoman Burke showed me all these areas that, you know, 10 years ago were more diverse, more affordable, and had longstanding businesses there that are now kind of, you know, what I like to call like the kind of cut and paste neighborhoods, where you could be in New York, in Brooklyn, in San Francisco, or in Oakland, or in New Orleans, or Austin, or Portland, or Spokane, and it would kind of look the same no matter what. Like, there's that fancy $4 coffee shop, there's the craft beer place, there's the yoga place, the houses, you know, are all kind of designed the same, and that's kind of your sign that gentrification is there, and it's becoming more rapid. So yeah, I really saw, you know, and then I saw there are all these developments that are kind of slated to be built. Yeah, I mean, on the surface, and especially if you read the media and the super conservative paper in Spokane, you wouldn't think gentrification is a problem there. But when you actually talk to people on the ground level, it definitely is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because our vacancy is really low and the things being built, I'd say either not being communicated what they'll be, or they're being put forward as affordable, but at prices that might be considered affordable housing somewhere like Seattle or San Francisco.
Right, exactly. And you're seeing this a lot. I mean, even the mayor like had a campaign to hack Washington, I think it was called, where it was like basically like figure out how to live in Washington more cheaply. And it was like specifically targeted at Seattle people and other people in the Pacific Northwest to like move to Spokane because it's cheaper and you can be a creative here for a lower price. And that was also something I was really surprised by, that you mentioned the vacancy rate is like the same as like New York's vacancy rate. Mm-hmm. So even though it's a smaller city and people think, oh, gentrification is not a problem here, you actually are having the same rental and housing crunch that a lot of cities in full-blown housing crisis are.
Mm-hmm. And I was just poking around and found an article that you wrote about that, about housing stock. And you talked about it some, I'm sure, in the book and in your talk. This idea that a lot of places like New York City, definitely not so in Spokane, but let me just find this article. The headline, it's from last year, and the headline is Evict the Rich.
Right.
And the subtitle, which I really like, is The One Neat Trick to Solving the Housing Crisis. So can you talk about that pattern a little bit and how that might play out in a less large city?
Sure. So I think we live with this persistent myth that really needs to die. And the reason it's a myth is because you have what are called YIMBY activists, which are really active in San Francisco and some in New York. The yes in my backyard, as opposed to NIMBY, no in my backyard, who say the reason we're in a housing crisis is because there's not enough housing. We need to build more and more housing, and that will solve the problem. The crazy thing is there is enough housing. There's tons of housing. There are empty houses all over. And there's lots of zoning issues that go into that that we could use to build new housing too that's actually affordable. But what happens when you just kind of do unrestricted development like the EMBs suggest is you get a city like New York where there's an overabundance of empty luxury apartments, or apartments that are only filled, 3 months out of the year. And as I mentioned in my talk and in my book, you know, the New York Times did the study of a certain section of New York next to Central Park called Billionaires Row now, because there's so many billionaires who, well, I was going to say live there, but they don't actually live there, because what the New York Times found is more than 50% of the apartments are vacant for more than 10 months out of the year, i.e. they're just little vacation homes and investment properties for extremely rich people. So at the same time you have increasing vacancy in cities, and this isn't only New York, this is many, many cities, you have increasing vacancy of apartments. You also have increasing homelessness and increasing rent prices. So the idea that the market could solve that solution is crazy, because that is the market solution, is to build more and more high-end housing. And then, you know, the YIMBY say that'll trickle down to poorer people, but that never happens. I mean, again, look at New York, look at San Francisco. No matter how much housing is built, it's all for a certain class of people. And even when they do build too much of it, they've done studies that show that lowers the rent by something like, 5 or 6%. It's not enough to actually make a dent in gentrification. So in Spokane, yeah, the vacancy rate's really low. There is more housing needed. I think there's a big misconception that, anti-gentrification activists are NIMBYs, not in my backyard. And, you know, what I always say is I grew up in the West Village, which at a certain point in New York City, at a certain point was affordable, and people always accuse me of being a NIMBY, and I'm like, no, build in 100-story skyscraper in the middle of the West Village. I don't care, as long as it's public housing or actually affordable housing. What I don't want is just completely unregulated development that bulldozes through neighborhoods and just turns them into kind of dead luxury zones, which is what we're seeing more and more. So in Spokane, I think that's a really, really critical distinction during this kind of fight and debate is, anti-gentrification activists are going to get accused of being NIMBYs, and it's important to say no, build as much housing as you want, as long as it's affordable to actual residents of Spokane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I mean, as a resident here, a lifelong resident here, that's how I feel about, as you brought up, hacking Washington. I'm like, okay, Seattle, send your artists and your poor people who've been priced out by the situation in Seattle, but don't send your tech people looking to invest in a second house, which is what that campaign right. is targeted toward.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So I guess I want to ask one other thing about the terrible sides of this. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit, you mentioned this about New Orleans in your talk and in your book, but can you talk about the racial dynamic of gentrification a little bit?
Sure. So, at the end of the day, gentrification is an economic issue. It's about people with more money and developers with more money displacing people with less money. But to just say that is, kind of only one side of the coin, because of how race operates in this country. You can't really separate race and class, because people of color, and especially Black people, have been purposefully denied the same wealth as white people. And probably the best example of this is in housing. If you go back to the 40s, 50s, 60s, and redlining, where banks essentially would not lend to neighborhoods that had a certain percentage of people of color, and that was because of a U.S. government decision to say that mortgages are not insurable in certain kinds of neighborhoods, i.e. majority Black, majority people of color neighborhoods. And so what you get is essentially during that redlining era, all of a sudden mortgages were opened to people who could put down 10% on a house, or even 5% sometimes, but only white people, essentially. So what you have is the creation of the suburbs. You create this massive boom in housing wealth for white Americans, And at the same time, you completely depress the real estate market of cities where the majority of people of color live. And so not only does that kind of rob the wealth of those cities, and, you know, you see during the 70s and 80s when every city was going through, you know, like, quote unquote, white flight, and everyone was scared of cities and all of that. That was, you know, based on a purposeful decision to essentially gift suburban housing wealth to white people and to deny it to people of color. So you fast forward to today, and, you know, as I said when I was in Spokane, like, it sounds so obvious, but I don't think we talk about this enough, how gentrification is just another symptom of racial inequality. There can't be gentrification without someone to gentrify and someone to be gentrified. So if everyone was on more equal footing economically, gentrification wouldn't be a thing. But you fast forward to today, when where is the vast majority of wealth in that most Americans have? It's in housing. It's their mortgage or their house. If people of color have been systemically denied that wealth, then you're in a situation today where the people who have that wealth are the people who have had houses mostly in the suburbs, who can now invest in that deeply depressed urban real estate market. So you have this completely unequal situation. That's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of race stuff. But that I think is kind of a really important point, just because it shows how far back this goes. You know, it's not just a recent problem. It's kind of the entire housing system was based on racism and racial inequality from the beginning. Today you can just see that play out. I would say, like, that is the big crux of why gentrification is happening how it is now. But then there's also just all that stuff is still happening. You know, it's not written into the laws of the U.S. government anymore, but housing discrimination is still a very real thing. The ability to get a loan is still a very real thing. The ability to even rent an apartment, racism is still extremely pervasive there too. And then you do have, like, specific government policies, like in New Orleans, after Katrina, when they shut down every public school and closed every housing project and essentially, like, tore apart and privatized their transportation network. They didn't say we're doing this because the city is a vast majority African-American, but that was kind of the implicit, you know, suggestion, which was essentially, like, made explicit by people like David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, who said it would be criminal to allow New Orleans to rebuild like it was before. We must do everything we can to make it a richer and better off city. Obviously New Orleans, Katrina, that is not comparable to Spokane, but I think you can see a lot of things that, you know, it doesn't have to say this is about racism at the top of a bill or at the top of a proposal for a housing development or whatever, for it to actually affect things in this class-based and race-based way.
Mm-hmm. And I believe what you said at the talk is that now there are 100,000 fewer African-Americans in New Orleans than there were before Katrina.
Yeah, it's really striking, because you hear politicians talk about how New Orleans has recovered. It's back to its pre-storm population of 450,000 or whatever it is, somewhere around there. It's a richer city than before. You know, come move here, everything is going great. But out of 450,000 people, there are 100,000 fewer Black people. So, yeah, it's just crazy to me that stat is not more widely known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in here, it's just like you said. I mean, we have huge development happening on the edge of one of our poorest and also most racially diverse neighborhoods that kind of popped up overnight because of weird circumstances. But I don't know that people have I don't know that race gets brought into that conversation as much as it should, just because of the dynamics of our city in general. But
right.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that's the other thing about, like, the NIMBY versus YIMBY debate is, where do all of these things end up getting built. It's in those neighborhoods where people have less political power and where, you know, the news cameras don't necessarily come when someone says, hey, I don't want this here. You know, if in a rich neighborhood like the neighborhood I'm from, used to be middle class, is now filthy rich, nothing new ever gets built there, not because they're, you know, not because, yeah, but not because of any reason besides the fact that it's filled with rich people who can say no. Instead, things get built in the neighborhoods least able to actually like handle the influx of newer, wealthier people, and in neighborhoods where people just have less of a say. And yeah, you can see that happening in every city, including Spokane.
So I know we've only got about 10 minutes left, so I'm wondering if we can shift to some solutions type discussion. You shared some good examples of how places are resisting this process. Like you said, it's a predictable process that we can observe and measure. It's not a magical force of nature. So what are some good examples that maybe a city that's in the point that we're in here in Spokane can learn from?
Yeah, so I hate to say this, but in the U.S., the examples are kind of few and far between just because we're kind of in a sad political moment right now. But that being said, I think there are things we can look to. I think it was Oregon that just passed a slew of housing protection measures that include rent control or some rent protections. In New York, I think about half of the apartments, if not more, are still rent regulated, which means they're either rent controlled and still at the same rent they were like nearly the same rent they were like 30 years ago, or they are rent regulated, which means that they are still able to raise the rents, but only by a certain percentage each year. So, you know, if New York wasn't rent regulated at all, you wouldn't have a functioning city anymore at this point, because the only way to get an affordable apartment is through the rent regulation system. And New York also has 800,000 people living in public housing, which I think is a great thing. And, you know, the problem with public housing isn't the fact that it's public housing. The problem is that it's completely underfunded and falling apart. So I think it's great that New York has almost a tenth of its population living in public housing. And I think other cities, which have spent decades knocking down their public housing, can look to New York as an example of, look, you can be a rich, successful city and still have public housing. Unfortunately, that's basically the end of the good news in the U.S., at least from the government side of things. If you look to many other economies in the rest of the world, whether it's Singapore, which I think something like 50% of all of its housing is publicly owned, to Sweden, where the government controls something like 70% of the land around cities, so it decides when things get developed and when they do not, to Berlin, where there's rent regulation, there's a new law that, or it's a few years old at this point, but there's a new law that that developers and landlords can't raise the rent by more than 15% when someone moves out of an apartment. So that essentially disincentivizes evictions, and they're starting to think about essentially taking over the apartment portfolios of large landlords and turning them into public and affordable housing. I would say essentially every other country is doing a lot more than we are right now. Part of that is just because of the structure of our government and the fact that we've, you know, kind of ceded so much federal control to the states. I mean, if you look back in the 1970s, the top tax rate on the richest Americans was like 75% or something. And now it's like 30%, but more like 15 if you include all the tax loopholes. So, you know, you're talking about literally trillions of dollars vacuumed out of our federal government that is now being hoarded by extremely wealthy people. And so, you know, there simply isn't enough money in government coffers to like make cities run or to pay for things like public housing. And, you know, the thing I like to point out to everyone, just to like intercept some of the skepticism, like, oh, that's socialist or communist or whatever. I mean, let's be real. Like, I am a leftist and I don't agree with, you know, a capitalist economy like the United States. But at the same time, look at Germany, look at Sweden, look at Hong Kong and Singapore and everywhere else. These are not communist societies. These are not, you know, slow moving economies. These are vast and healthy economies, and they still recognize the need for socialized housing programs and greater control over housing. So that's the government side of things. Long story short, the government in the U.S. is mostly bad, but things are starting to bubble up at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
At the more like community side of things, I think things are going a lot better, just in terms of like citizens taking things into their own hands and, you know, forcing politicians to do things, and also just figuring out their own solutions, like, you know, coming together collectives where they buy a piece of land and, you know, keep it affordable for a long time, and also just like increasing activism on the ground. So I think people are starting to like get together more around housing and take it seriously and you know, focus their activism on it. But I think there's still a disconnect between that happening at the ground level and then what's happening in our government.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's a situation where, as things get visibly worse in this regard, people will get over their squeamishness around phrases like public ownership and, you know, public anything here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I definitely see that happening more, where, you know, people are, I mean, and just in general, it's not just housing, but it's everything. You know, that there are all these studies that show that younger people are more okay with words like socialism than older people are, and that's because we live in a much, much different world than we used to, where all of a sudden more and more Americans are having problems affording rent and food and everything else. So it's not just housing where that's happening. The problem in terms of housing acting specifically is that gentrification also makes that a lot harder. Same time that it's more important to fight back, gentrification means that, you know, all of a sudden, if your rent is 30% or 50% higher, you have to work more in order to pay that, which means you have less time for activism. It also means that you're moving around more. You know, in New York, for example, I think New York, to me, it was one of the hardest cities to organize against gentrification, and because people were moving so much. I mean, so many of my friends were moving every 1 or 2 years, and if you live in one neighborhood 1 year and then another neighborhood the next year and then another in 3 years or whatever, you can't really, it's hard to become part of a community and part of a anti-gentrification activist group. So, you know, what I say to people when I travel to Spokane or other cities is, now is the time. You know, like in New York, in many ways, it's too late. You know, there are still things that can be done. They're working on passing like a slew of bills right now that could help things, but it's harder to do in New York now because it's already happened and because there's so much real estate money influencing everything now. Whereas if you kind of work on this issue now in Spokane, you have a chance to set it on the right course as opposed to trying to correct course after so many things go wrong.
Cool. Well, I think that's probably about all the time you have, but if folks want to learn more, want to follow your work, want to get your book, or if you have other resources to suggest, like a reading mm-hmm. list or something, where would you point folks who want to know more?
Sure. So not to sell my own books, but if you just go through the bibliography of my book, and I think I also have a further reading section and also like a suggestions of what to do section. You know, I have hundreds of sources in my book that can give people a place to go. And also, I would recommend Gentrification of the Mind by Sarah Shulman. I can't remember everything off the top of my head.
Yeah, no worries.
Check out my book. You could probably get the, if you don't want to buy my book, although, you know, please do. You can probably go on Amazon and like go to the last few pages to look at the bibliography and get everything there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time and for your work. And hopefully we'll get it done here in Spokane.
Yeah, thank you. Good luck with the fight.
Awesome. Thanks.
So again, that was author P.E. Moskowitz talking about their book, How to Kill a City, talking about gentrification, a big topic, an often misunderstood topic. If you missed any part of that interview and you want to catch it, you can find the podcast. That's available at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. And now, without further ado, I will share the interview with City Council member Kate Burke, who brought P.E. Moskowitz to town. She'll talk a little bit about what a city can do and what our city is doing. So stay tuned for that. And again, that podcast is available later tonight. Thanks for listening.
All right. So in the second part of the show here, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio. I'm here with City Council member Kate Burke.
Hello.
I'm really glad you're finally on the show. I feel like it's overdue.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
You can come back for the full show sometime.
Perfect.
So we're doing this interview with P.E. Moskowitz, who's the author of How to Kill a City, and you brought them to Spokane to talk. So I'm curious about what your inspiration for doing that was, and why you wanted to have a conversation about gentrification in Spokane.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you doing this piece, and it is really important to our city and most cities. It's really important that you zone in and figure out what issues are coming up and what we need to work on as a community. But one of the things that I've learned as being an elected official on council, being a young person in this role has been really rough for our community, I think. It's hard for them to listen to a young female speak and be passionate and have opinions and be outspoken. And so I have found it really hard to convey my messages through myself. So when I was reading How to Kill a City, I really just felt like P.E. was saying all of the same things that I was saying over and over and over again. But I felt like I was bashing my head against a wall. So I thought, well, if I could bring P.E. to Spokane to convey that message, then it kind of takes me out of the picture, and people can hear it from, you know, the person who's writing the story, who has lived through gentrification, who has studied gentrification, and who has many books around these similar issues. So that's kind of where the idea came from, and I'm really glad that I brought them to Spokane because it's just really, again, it's a huge piece. It's a huge piece of the puzzle of where we need to go and where we don't need to go in terms of city policies.
Yeah. And then the panel that you put together, I'm assuming you put together the panel also, which featured Terry Anderson from the Tenants Union, Tara Dowd. It's been a while now, so I'm blanking on everyone. But I think you did I'm assuming that you brought the panelists to do the same thing and to share the diverse perspectives that you can't just say, right, hey, trust me,
exactly,
I think this is true.
Yeah. So having a group of people who are specialists or people who have lived this experience or deal with communities who are directly impacted with these types of issues is another way to kind of bring in different voices and perspectives and share the same type of efforts and what are our solutions.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess I was really impressed with the turnout. What did you expect for this event and what happened? And I guess what is happening next after having this conversation?
Yeah, I thought it was a really great turnout. I think there was probably like 100, 150 people. And I wasn't sure what to expect. I never know. I've put on a lot of events like this and sometimes I get 10 people, sometimes I get 150. So you just kind of never know. But it's always good having community partners that are spreading the word about it and sending it out in their newsletters and things like that. And that's what we had at this event. So we had the health district jump in to want to sponsor, as well as Empire Health Foundation and Better Health Together. And they all three are really great partners in this community working on equity issues and health impact issues. So it was a really good time. And then they all sent it out to their communities, which got a big reach. We got some media around it, and then, you know, just putting it on Facebook and whatnot. So I felt like it was a good turnout. And I think, you know, after, right, we're in the after stage. I think part of what I want to do with these educational events is now we have ideas planted in our community's head. So our community knows what we shouldn't do and what we should be doing. And I think PE says it good. One person in the audience asked, well, government's the reason that we're in this place. Why should we trust them now? And PE eloquently said, you know, well, I still don't trust government, but I trust the people. And now we're educating the people. And mm-hmm. so I think it's really important for us to keep doing that. So I won't stop educating. So I'm going to have some more events. The next one's on equity in our community. And that's going to be he's a great speaker. And it'll probably be in October. But also through this comes conversation pieces. So, you know, people that attended that could then go and start observing the community and seeing if there were really these issues happening in our community. And you can see them. They're plain and simple right in front of our faces, but we choose not to look at them. The other reason I brought PE was so that elected officials in this community could learn something from experts. And unfortunately, we didn't have a large turnout of elected officials. Although next time I bring a speaker in, I'm going to make sure that they come to our committee meetings so that they can really explain what's going on. But I think what's next is what policies do we want to work on, and how do we convey what we learned there through, you know, these masses of people that now know this information, and how are they using that to push government to do the right thing?
Mm-hmm. And I guess there were some really concrete policy solutions out of that talk. They weren't things that come up a lot here, you know, things like rent control, things like really increasing investment in public housing. What do you think some of the lower hanging fruit is in Spokane in terms of policy?
Well, we just came from a landlord-tenant meeting because we're working on a policy to help keep people in their homes and give some more rights to tenants. And it's a touchy subject, but hopefully we can get some common ground worked out. We'll be doing, if this passes, it will require that landlords have to get a business license and then pay a fee on the amount of doors that they have. And that money would go to a relocation fund for tenants that have to relocate due to rent increases or anything else like that. And there's a lot of other things in the policy. What's hard is I feel like this is the first time we've really had this conversation. And so we're taking the status quo and we're really shaking it up and we're shaking it really hard. And it's shock for a lot of people. I think it's good. I think we need to have these conversations. And I'm not going to stop having them. So I hope we can find some common ground there. The other kind of harder ones are, you know, just cause eviction. For some reason, I don't think all landlords really understand the concept of just cause eviction. So it's not saying that you can't evict somebody. It's actually just giving you reasons why you can evict them. And that just gives peace of mind to the tenant. And so that's one that we need it. We need it in our community. And there's vulnerable people in housing that aren't being treated well and being evicted for no reason. And they want to know why they're being evicted. And so hopefully we can stop some of the evictions. And if there's no cause, and then, you know, if there is a cause, then they're in the law to be able to evict somebody. But we don't have that in place right now. And for some reason, that's a really hot button issue. And so I'm trying to wade through that to be able to pass it has been interesting. And then, you know, there's a lot of other, there's a lot with zoning. I mean, we can do a lot with zoning. I'm working on an inclusionary zone, which again is a hot button issue. It would basically say that in certain areas of the city, if a developer was going to come in and build housing, a certain portion of that housing needs to be affordable or low income. And it's something like 5%. if you do something really high, people likely won't build. But something smaller that's more manageable, it still works. It still pencils out in the end. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on inclusionary zoning. And, you know, of course, statewide policies we need to continue to advocate to change that are going to have better, you know, security for tenants, as well as, you know, like you mentioned, rent control is something that we cannot do here locally because it's a state law.
Mm-hmm. So the inclusionary zoning is interesting. That's the first time hearing about that here. And that's really exciting because I think, you know, we are pushing, the city's pushing for more density and more people living downtown, which as someone who lives downtown and who has for a long time, I'm all for that. I want more people to live downtown, but absolutely, I don't want to get priced out of my beautiful neighborhood in the process just as a renter. But I think we've heard a lot of some of these specific developments downtown and near downtown, which will not be named, made a lot of promises verbally about affordable units, and then when they rolled out, they weren't my idea of affordable. They weren't, I think, Spokane median income idea of affordable. So this is kind of codifying that, right, and defining it.
Yeah, I think the thing that we've done a lot in Spokane, and we've done it really well and we've overdone it, is incentives. We have so many incentives, but guess what? Incentives don't make people do stuff. And right now, no one is opting into those incentive programs. And to me, that means that's where government needs to step in and say, no, this is not right. We're lacking affordable housing units, and we need people to step up and do the right thing. And the only way to do that is by putting in law that makes you have to do it. And it, you can still pencil out. There are developers all throughout other cities who have inclusionary zones that are doing just fine. And so I think it's a big step, but I think we need to, again, have that conversation and shake it up again and make sure that we're getting our word out there that these are things that are helpful for a community that are going to progress us into a good place, you know?
Yeah. And I guess something else I'm curious about. So your district, is your district dominantly, is it pretty balanced between homeowners and renters?
It depends on what neighborhood. Like Logan's much higher of a renter population because GU's right there. But I would say overall, I have more renters in my district than other districts in the city of Spokane.
Mm-hmm. So are you hearing, I guess, from, I mean, I guess you're inspired by your own beliefs about how the city should be. But are you hearing a lot about housing from your constituents?
Absolutely. And I think it's important, like, yeah, I have my own passions, but I don't act on anything unless I have a reason to act on it. So everything I'm working on is coming from constituents or organizations pushing it. So like right now I'm working on a low-income bus pass. That's not coming because I believe in it. It's coming because there's agencies coming to me every day saying, whoa, people cannot ride our bus because it's too expensive. We need to fix that. And so it's the same thing with housing. Every day, you know, weekly, you know, every day I get emails or phone calls or Facebook messages like, I don't know what to do. This just happened. My rent got increased. I'm being displaced. I'm going to be homeless. I can't get on a voucher program. I have a voucher. I can't find housing. I mean, I hear this all the time. So, you know, yes, I believe in these things, but it's also really heavily coming from the people that are being affected by this.
Mm-hmm. I guess on the topic of being affected, the things you're talking about, I think are awesome in terms of zoning, and it's kind of angled toward the future. And I think that's a really hard thing with planning in general, is it's really hard to figure out how are we including the infrastructure we already have. And I think Spokane's doing a lot of great things with infrastructure, but something that really stuck out to me when PE talked, they said that amenities without protections become threats. And so as we're building some of these new things and the Central City Line and, you know, there's a new park right by my house, which I really enjoy, but also it gives me a light sense of anxiety because I know that I don't have rent protection and I know that my rent could just increase.
Absolutely. No. And one thing I, you know, gathered from PE's book was no matter what we do as a city, any sort of investment into a low-income area, whether it be fixing a pothole, redoing an entire street, putting in a park, that starts the ball of gentrification. Enhancing our public transit also does that. And I don't think people in this community really understand what that means. And I say that because I was in a meeting the other day and we were talking about how great the Central City Line is. And I am just very excited about it, right? I want to, here's gentrification at its finest. I want to move to Mission Street or that area so I can be right by the Central City Line. That is what millennials want. And that's, you know, and we're going to move close to transit options. But what happens is me moving in and, you know, first of all, restrict somebody else from moving into that, you know, lower income home. But as we put in these amenities, then we see that ball start rolling of property values raising, which means rents start raising or people see opportunities and come in. I really, really like this analogy. The white man came to America and he was like, I see an opportunity. I'm going to colonize. That's exactly what gentrification is on a smaller scale. White people are seeing this opportunity in a low-income area and they're going to colonize. They're taking advantage of people going through this. And so that is just plain and simple. It's been going on since we became a state or a country. And so it's frustrating that we really haven't grasped that and really seen how to mitigate it. And, you know, I keep saying low-income people deserve to have a nice park by their house. And they deserve to have transit around them. But what happens in Seattle when they chose to put the transit line through Beacon Hill, that is no longer a low-income neighborhood like it used to be because the rich people saw opportunities and moved in there, or they redid housing to then have renters in there. And so it's not really, yeah, it's just a problem we see. And I see this threat with West Central, with Chief Gary, and with Brown's Addition and downtown as a place where we really need to be putting some arms around those vulnerable communities to stop this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you for that. So I guess that's where the protection part comes in. And that's what you were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, because, I mean, we all want to live next to a park, right? That's kind of the point at the end of the day. So I guess, where do you think that I've been running into something more philosophically with people around this idea of shared space and the idea of public space? And mm-hmm. that's something that PE and I talked about also mm-hmm. In our conversation. So how do you think we can do some of that more? We can do it through policy, but how do you think we can get people a little more open to that idea of a different kind of idea of shared space and the public than they might have now?
So are you talking like more apartment dwelling, co-op housing type stuff, or
that too, but also just the idea that we collectively own certain things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's really hard to wrap our heads around that as Americans, because we've really grasped on to this freedom mm-hmm. is individual and freedom to drive my own car, even though I'm driving with, you know, 5,000 other people to the downtown core every day. I have to drive in my own car and I have to live in my own, you know, single family home. We just read an article today about the fact that, you know, single family housing is actually really a thing of the past. I mean, we've moved past that and we're still grasping for it. Like there's a portion of us that are wanting to go back to that. And we can't. With the amount of people moving into the cities, we need to start being innovative with our space and start actually, you know, diving into solutions. So, you know, I say we're going to have to make a change. People aren't going to like it. Some people are. And we're just going to have to do it. I mean, it's going to have to happen one way or another.
Yeah, that's yeah, that's right. Especially, I mean, that's not even getting into climate disruption, any right. of the other reasons that we might have to do that. Just sheer
space,
square footage.
Yeah. And that we have facts that people are moving to cities. I mean, that is just where they're going. And, you know, if we don't have regional planning approaches and conversations between different jurisdictions and reasoning for putting certain types of housing in certain places and transit around it, and, you know, all of these things, it's a robust conversation. But if we don't have that, we're going to continue to sprawl, we're going to continue to be bad to our earth, and we're not going to succeed. And we're going to continue to see a rise in homelessness. But we can do it. There are definitely other countries who have really stepped up and mitigated some of these issues. But we as Americans have had a hard time really grasping onto the idea. And I'm not really sure why. But I think, it's a little bit of that freedom thing. And you're right, public space, mm-hmm. It's everybody's. We all live here together collectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we just have another minute or so left. But if people want to get involved in this locally, and if they want to learn more, where would you point them to?
Well, I would say, first of all, make sure you're registered to vote. That's really, 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 really important. I'm always available for coffee or a phone call. I try to, meet with anybody that wants to. So I'm happy to plug people in that way. Getting involved in the tenants union and different organizations that help vulnerable people in our community is really important. And just getting educated yourself. Read How to Kill a City. Read books. Read articles. And there's a lot of information out there on a lot of these things. So also coming to testify at City Hall is super great. So we have our meetings every Monday night at 6 p.m. at City Hall. And it's just a good opportunity. You get 3 minutes to testify. You can talk about whatever you want. And it's so good to hear from people. Because like I said, it drives me. And I know that it will spark other people to be like, wait, what are they talking about? Mm-hmm. I need to look at that. So. Yeah. But I'll put my email out there. It's KateBurke@SpokaneCity.org. Again, happy to meet up for coffee or talk more about this issue offline at any moment. And it's kind of my life. So
yeah, it kind of is. Yeah, it's really great to see. So I guess any Monday that you're listening to the show, you can listen to the show. You can listen to half of Democracy Now! And you can then roll to City Hall. I mean, what an afternoon.
Do it. Truly.
So, cool. If you don't have anything else to add, I think that's it. But thanks so much.
I really appreciate this opportunity. Yeah. And again, we'll do it again because
we'll
need
do
to
a
talk.
Full hour.
Yeah,
we could do a full hour pretty
easily.
We have
so much to talk about. But I appreciate you focusing on these really important issues in our community. So
thanks. Cool.
All right. So that was Councilperson Kate Burke. Thank you, Kate, for coming on the show. And before her, you heard the voice of author P.E. Moskowitz talking about their book, How to Kill a City. If you missed any part of this interview and you'd like to catch it, the podcast will be posted later on today. Again, this show was completely pre-recorded, but the podcast will be up later today. You can find that at kyrs.org/show/praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S. If you have questions about the show, the guests, ideas for future shows, anything else, you can always shoot me an email at praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, @kyrs.org. Thanks for listening, and I'll be back next week.